Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
Qala al-Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, khayru al-umuri awsatuha.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai, Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Kadhim was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. We find that the biographers of Muslim history have unanimously agreed that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people when it came to obeying and worshipping Allah the Almighty. What is interesting is that these biographers have also written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam suffered through many tortures and pains. He suffered through many hardships and trials and tribulations. For example, he was put into dark and isolated prisons. In these prisons, some which were incredibly small, no bigger than the size of two or three people put together. But in these dark prisons, it is written in the history books that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was tortured. And despite these tortures and trials and tribulations, those same biographers have written that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the greatest of the people in obeying and worshipping Allah. And these biographers have written that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was so great in his obedience and his worship and his ibadat and his ubudiyah of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, to the extent that he had calluses like that on the knees of a camel upon his head or upon his knees because of the great extent and the great number and the length of his prostrations, his sujood for Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام من ذكر رجلا من خلفه بما هو فيه مما عرفه الناس لم يغتبه، ومن ذكره من خلفه بما هو فيه مما لا يعرفه الناس اغتابه.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "He who talks about someone behind his back, mentioning what is true about him and what people already know, then he has not backbite about him. Whereas he who talks about someone behind his back, about something that is true, but that people do not know about, then he has backbit about him."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the beautiful conversations that we find in the historical texts, which are related to the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find in one of these places that in this conversation, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far advises his son to be earnest in his affairs and to be cautious of laziness. When advising his son, we find in this conversation that Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim says to his son, "Beware of laziness and boredom, for they prevent you from your share in this world and your share in the next." And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find, was opposed to laziness. He was opposed to being unemployed and not caring about it. And of course, he did not like the people who had these kind of qualities, because these qualities of laziness and boredom and not caring whether you have a job or not, and not caring whether you provide for your family or not, these kind of qualities, they lead to poverty, they lead to lowliness, and they lead to losing the self-respect that one has. Furthermore, it can be said that whoever has these kind of qualities of laziness and not caring for these things and being ignorant and careless and neglectful, this kind of individual is regarded to be among the dead, because they neither think nor they contemplate about their life. And so in this conversation between his son and himself, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far says, "Beware of laziness, beware of boredom, beware of not being active in your life, because your share in this world is attained and acquired and achieved via being active. And of course, your share in the next world, in the hereafter, in the akhirah, is also obtained by being active." This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
You know, one of the names that we call him is Kazim, which means that comes from Kazm. He would refrain from getting disappointed or upset or angry. He would control his anger. وَكَازِمِينَ الْغَيْثِ وَالْعَافِينَ عَلِ النَّاسِ, as the Quran says, that he would control the anger. And he will afi, he will forgive the people. Always forgiving. And it really reflects that how mazloom the Imam was. Majority of the time of his life, he left in very dead and dreadful and dark prisons. History is self-evidence, where we, when we visit Baghdad, those who have the opportunity to visit Baghdad and those who have visited these prisons, you could find that these prisons, when a person enters to these historical sites of the prisons of the Imam, one is unable to even stand up properly. One is unable to really stand up properly. You know, that's how Imam was praying there, in those sort of very thin, low roof prisons. Imagine how he might have been breathing there.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Albino animals are rare and very vulnerable. So when you find one, you need to make sure they get all the care they need to survive. And now, Colombian vets are doing all they can to help the very first case of an albino baby, Jaguarundi, that's been rescued there. Fire department volunteers rescued this female cub in the urban areas of the Abora Valley region. The vets are now giving it primary medical attention. The baby Jaguarundi will then be transferred to a conservation park in the city of Medellin for more protection. A local expert explains why they cannot put back the animal into the wild.
At this point, this animal cannot be released to the wild due to its albino condition. It is predisposed to certain health disorders, certain disadvantages when performing in the wild. Therefore, the only alternative for it is to end his life in a park such as this.
Albino animals face many difficulties in the wild and struggle with basic survival skills. They do not have good eyesight, and due to their lack of pigmentation, they cannot camouflage. Therefore, just like endangered species, human monitoring would increase their chances of survival.
Swimming in sub-zero temperatures can be unimaginable for most people, but not for a group of athletes who've tested their skills and strength in Prague's Vltava River. 360 people from 8 countries gathered in the Czech capital to participate in an annual winter swimming event. The air temperature was -6 degrees Celsius, with water temperatures dipping to as low as 3 degrees. The event honors Alfred Nikodem, a Czech swimmer who braved the frigid waters in Prague for the first time in 1923, starting a tradition that has been kept alive ever since. Now, the world's most powerful observatory is finally on its million-kilometer journey after several technical delays. The NASA telescope named James Webb blasted off into orbit on Saturday, heading to an outpost that's 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. The observatory was in the making for some 3 decades and cost about $10 billion. It left Earth enclosed in a rocket and from a launch pad in South America. The journey will last a month. The telescope is the size of a tennis court. And if everything goes according to plan, it will enter service in June. Astronomers are hoping they can learn more about the origins of the universe once it starts beaming back new clues. The school in Spain is offering students an opportunity to join a special orchestra. The project dubbed The Music of Recycling brings unwanted junk back to life by transforming them into musical instruments. And here is how they sound. The project offers the instruments to the orchestra in one of Madrid's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. The students say the orchestra keeps them away from mischief and out of serious trouble while giving them an artistic outlet. Several dozens of children are taking music classes for members of the orchestra as part of the project. The ensemble has put on several concerts across Spain, but because of the pandemic, they had to pause their performances. The project is run by Spanish environmental group and is inspired by similar orchestra in Paraguay. To most people, an eggshell is something that gets tossed in the garbage, but to one Chinese artist, the delicate eggshell is the chosen canvas to express art and create mini masterpieces. Zhu is a talented craftsman who has created a series of unique egg sculptures with the theme of Beijing's Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games. Icons of ice and snow sports, as well as etchings of the 2022 Olympic mascots, are showcased in this series. The thin and delicate texture of the shells adds to the difficulty of the craft, which creates a sense of fragile beauty. Zhu says his fascination with eggshell art started when he was very young.
The Christmas season is when people around the world left out a dose of joy in the form of Santas. But it's different in central Thailand on this Christmas Eve. Thai children were ecstatic to see Santa Claus's distributing presents, but this time in the shape of elephants. Dressed in Santa costumes, five elephants carried dolls, face masks, and sanitizers for students. They were surrounded by many human Santa Clauses as well. But the students cheered with joy while reaching out for presents from the jumbos. Event managers say their goal was to encourage students to stay vigilant during the pandemic, plus they wanted to give the children some fun to look forward after months of virtual classes. The event is a yearly highlight for a school that caters to students from kindergarten to secondary level.
Scientists have made a stunning discovery inside a fossilized dinosaur egg. An embryo that's been preserved in a perfect shape. The embryo was found inside a 66-million-year-old fossil in a museum in the Chinese city of Guangzhou. Paleontologists say it's the best dinosaur embryo ever found. They're hoping it would help a lot in finding the links between modern birds and dinosaurs. The fossil belongs to a toothless Oviraptorosaur, a group of feathered dinosaurs that used to live in what's now Asia and North America. The embryo is nicknamed Baby Yin Liang after the Chinese museum that houses the fossil.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
After almost 2 years of isolation due to the coronavirus pandemic, Mexicans are once again celebrating Christmas together and a fear in the capital, Mexico City. Here's more.
It is a joy that we've been planning for a long time to go out and to take this picture because we've been locked up for 2 years and we couldn't go out. Now there's green light. We decided to go out with the whole family to live these moments together.
A few things are different than the fur as far as Mexican tradition goes. Santa, and not the traditional three wise men, give out presents. Families also have their photos taken by the Father Christmas. These are rare moments amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attendees say the situation is complicated, but they will try their best to make it work. The festival has been made possible by the introduction of green passes, which indicate full vaccination against COVID.
Exchanging gifts is an inseparable and also the most joyful part of Christmas traditions. How about sharing the joy with animals? Now, a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali is doing so by giving presents to its animals. The presents are actually the animals' favorite foods served in a different way. Animals spend time unpacking the gifts decorated in Christmas theme and then access the food they like the most. Feeding in this way arouses the animals' curiosity and fills them with excitement. Zookeepers say they want to show that animals always receive care at their zoo.
It is a very cool way to generate empathy for visitors. Although animals do not know that it's Christmas or that it's a special date, it is important to generate that message in visitors that we make care of our animals and that for us it is important to share with them this Christmas season.
The zookeepers say they make use of enrichment strategies for their initiative. They actually stimulate the behaviors of a range of animals, even the species they keep in an aquarium. Running a marathon is pretty tough for most. But a group of people has upped the ante to take the competition to sub-zero temperatures of Antarctica. 62 people descended on the Union Glacier from around the world and ran over a 42-kilometer course. The area is just a few hundred kilometers from the South Pole. Soft snow and temperatures as low as minus 15 degrees Celsius did not stop Latvia Evia Rain from setting a women's record. The event was delayed for several days because of a massive storm that battered the area a week ago. Adventurers and athletes have been putting their strength to the test in the race every year since 2005. A tiny baby mouse deer takes its first steps into the world with a round body and spindly legs in a Polish zoo. It was born on December 2nd and now stands roughly 10 centimeters tall. The Warsaw Zoo got its first mouse deer last year and a second one last summer. Zoo staff are surprised that the pair of new arrivals have produced offspring so quickly. Mouse deer are among the smallest mammals. Even as adults, they only weigh around 2 kilograms. Contrary to their name, they are neither from mouse nor from deer species. Some mammalogists consider them living fossils because they haven't evolved much over millennia. Beachgoers in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro have been surprised by very rare visitors, a family of orcas. The family of three was seen swimming in shallow waters of a crowded beach south of the city. The group didn't seem to care at all about the presence of people on their paddleboards. Footage of the orcas quickly spread on social media because they don't usually come that close to the coast. A local biologist says the whales were likely to drawn. They were likely drawn to the area by a cold current from further south.
What we see in the video is a family group that has a male and a female who have a calf. It is common that the orcas come from a colder current where there is also a shoal, and they reach the south, the north in fact, and end up hitting our coast. Then they rest in warmer waters such as Copacabana Beach, Ipanema Beach, and Barra de Tijuca.
The biologist says the mammals pose no risk to humans despite the label killer whales. He says there is no record of their attacks on humans. Researchers suspect that the migration patterns of whales could be influenced by climate change and the resulting changes in water temperatures. Serving customers in a high-tech way. That's what a traditional restaurant in the German state of Bavaria does. What's the goal? The owner explains.
We decided ourselves for this robot because of the lack of staff. Looked for support in a technological form. It's not a replacement, of course, but it's a relief for the waiters.
The robot is equipped with a trolley and it can easily move around in the restaurant. When it comes to saving time, the high-tech waiters is of great help, especially when the restaurant is packed with customers. The owner says most customers first become surprised when they come across the robot. He says waiters are still present to serve meals and receive orders. Butterfly gardens are a place where you can watch these tiny creatures and marvel at their beauty. But have you ever wondered where these butterflies come from? These colorful creatures are in fact bred in butterfly farms. And Donald Orsay from Costa Rica is one of the biggest breeders, making that the mission of his life. He produces somewhere around 2,500 pupas per week. Arce is one of the world's largest exporters of the popular Morpho species. Listen to him explain why he is fascinated by them.
A Morpho has a great advantage. It is a butterfly that rarely stays still, unless it is very late, because when it is getting dark, it settles down, but normally it flies constantly. It flies by in the butterfly gardens.
Arce's butterflies have their own special diet. They feed on bananas and a concoction that he keeps its ingredients secret. Morphos are popular because of their color. They are shimmering blue on one side and brown on the other side. That's perfect for camouflage. Butterflies are really fun to watch, but they serve a critical purpose as well. They help plants reproduce by pollination, thus strengthening the ecosystem.
A few hooks and a shelf have transformed a wall in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, into an outdoor charity. It's called the Wall of Kindness, which is painted with the slogan, "Grab a jacket if you need one, leave a jacket if you can spare one." Here, people can donate their winter clothes or warm boots if they have some extra. The Wall of Kindness is meant to help those in need, including the homeless, to stay warm. The wall was set up by a real estate company, and the organizer says people have responded positively with the high turnover. The move was inspired by a trend that has been seen in Iran over the years. Several other countries across the world, such as India, have also organized similar outdoor charities.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you, every single moment.
In the limelight.
Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Kleiner Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rural America is facing an invisible eviction crisis. Stay tuned for more. About 70 miles northwest of the U.S. capital, in the affluent Virginia countryside and across the state line into West Virginia, there is a house on a hill in a deteriorating neighborhood. Inside sits Melody Schaefer, rubbing her red-rimmed eyes at the dining table. Her husband, Chris Pasco, paces between the dimly lit kitchen and living room. Paint peels from a nearby door frame. Schaefer repeatedly says when asked where they would go now that they were about to be evicted. I have no clue. It was the day before Thanksgiving. At the bustling Walmart down the road, shoppers filled their carts and potatoes, stuffing, green beans, and pumpkin pie, oblivious to the scene that had unfolded that morning in Country Courthouse. Jefferson County Magistrate Judge Vicky Dangelo had ruled in favor of three landlords and ordered the tenants living in their homes, including Schaefer and Pasco, to vacate by December 3rd. To wait and do this in the winter time, right before it gets cold, Schaefer trailed off. Statistically speaking, not much is known about evictions that are occurring outside the U.S. urban areas during the COVID-19 pandemic. There is no national system that monitors eviction cases in real time. The largest set of publicly available data is gathered by Princeton Eviction Lab, which is tracking cases in 6 states and 31 cities. Data in those urban areas show mixed trends. In places with few tenant protections, the number of cases is growing up, according to Eviction Lab. But tenants' lawyers in the country's less populated regions say they are also handling more cases now that the federal moratorium on evictions has expired. States like West Virginia, South Dakota, Delaware, and Arkansas have been slow to dole out rental assistance from the federal government, money that's meant to be a levy holding back a flood of evictions. Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Other pots of money have been slow to be spent too, including $9 billion the Department of Housing and Urban Development sent to states and cities to combat housing-related COVID-19 fallout. Brent Thompson, Executive Director for East River Legal Services, which provides representation to low-income residents in eastern South Dakota, said, "My frustration is widespread. It's just sad when you see a continuing problem day in and day out, and there is only so much you can do for them." Thompson said the biggest hurdle he has faced in South Dakota is lack of information for tenants, many of whom were living in poverty before COVID-19 swept through the state. Thompson said, "We have developed a culture where people don't tend to avail themselves for protections afforded to them. This isn't a new problem. It's a problem that's being magnified by the pandemic and reaching a crisis point because of the pandemic. Back when the federal eviction moratorium was in place, people living in South Dakota tended to simply move elsewhere when their landlords threatened to evict, rather than fight for their right to stay," Thompson said. "And many tenants either don't know about the state's $200 million rental assistance allocation from the federal government or haven't been able to access those funds. As of October 31st, only 4% of that money had been distributed to tenants and landlords, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. A November report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition placed South Dakota and Wyoming last among states for the share of rental assistance they had sent to tenants and landlords. The South Dakota Housing Development Authority, which is administering the state's rental assistance programs, has distributed aid to more than 5,200 households with money from the federal government," said Amanda Weiss-Graham, spokesperson for the agency. The state approved 75% of the completed applications it received. Weiss-Graham noted the need for assistance isn't as acute in South Dakota because the state's businesses weren't forced to close during the pandemic, and residents weren't required to stay home. But Thompson's office saw a 30% jump in eviction cases for 4 months in a row earlier this year, and he said the need for attorneys is growing. Only 8 attorneys cover this 33-county region, which spans 30,000 square miles. His territory is home to a large population of undocumented migrant workers and indigenous people, groups that have historically been exploited by landlords. South Dakota ranks last in terms of access to legal representation, according to the National Center for Access to Justice. In Delaware, landlords have been hesitant to sign up for rental assistance programs, said Dan Atkins, executive director of Community Legal Aid Society Incorporation. Landlords have balked at providing financial records to the state government, and they haven't wanted to give up the right to evict tenants in exchange for receiving rental payments. "You can drag a horse to water, but you can't make them drink," Atkins said. "We will drag them to the water, but we don't know if they will drink." Many of the lowest income tenants in Delaware don't know about the rental assistance available to them. They don't have reliable access to internet, and some people aren't able to read, Atkins said. "All of this is a challenge when the state requires pages of documentation proving financial hardship. Plus, there is a narrative in the low-income community that no one is going to help," he said. Over 80% of landlords are represented in eviction cases in Delaware, Atkins said, while fewer than 5% of tenants have lawyers by their side. "There is not enough legal aid to go around," Atkins said. "We are starting to see the floodgates open a bit, and we are looking over our shoulder and wondering if it's going to be a big tidal wave soon." As of October 31st, only 10% of Delaware's $200 million allocation in rental assistance had been doled out to tenants and landlords, according to data from the Treasury Department. In Arkansas, state officials were lagging behind most other states for the first 7 months of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, but they picked up the pace of distributing money in October, Treasury Department data show. Still, that's only used up 22% of the state's $174 million allocation. The public badly needs access to rental assistance funds, said Kendall Levington, housing subject area manager for the Center for Arkansas Legal Services, adding that the state amended its policies to make it easier for tenants to access the aid. He said, "I just hope that it isn't too late for most people." As of October 15th, Levin's office had handled twice as many landlord-tenants cases in 2021 as it did in the same period in 2020. Eviction in Arkansas is uniquely punitive, Levin said. It's the only state in the U.S. that charges tenants with a crime for failing to pay their rent and vacate their home. Nearly 450 people were charged with that misdemeanor crime between March 2020 and November 2021 in Arkansas, according to data from the state's court system. Of those, 133 were found guilty. Back in West Virginia, Schaffer and Pasco went living in a neighborhood littered with rotting tires and stacks of lumber. The house next door was shrouded by dead bodies. As of December 15, they hadn't found a place they could afford to rent, and they were thinking they had have to spend the night outside. They didn't apply for rental assistance because the process would take weeks to complete, and Pasco's income as a handyman in the flooring business had dried up. So had the income of Johnny Harrell, who was in the tree trimming business in nearby Charlestown. Harrell said his employer died and he was suddenly out of work. He said he had never missed a rental payment before, but he could no longer afford to pay $500 a month. His landlord, Alex Salgado, purchased a small building Harrell was living in about 18 months ago. Harrell was the first person he had to evict. Salgado said, "It's a circle, right? I need to get money in so I can pay for the building." Like Schaffer and Pasco, Harrell found out the day before Thanksgiving that he would be evicted by December 3rd. He didn't want to move into his son's home, which was already crowded. The only place he could think to live was inside an old pop-up camper on a nearby campground. "It isn't insulated, and the temperatures were already dropping below freezing at night." At the last minute, Harold's relatives helped him rent an apartment in Maryland so he wouldn't have to sleep in the camper. "It felt loosey," Harold said of his experience in a courtroom. "You work all your life and you're fine, and you keep going no matter what happens. And you know what? It was heartbreaking."
From the day he started his presidential campaign, U.S. President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the US goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati, and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world, and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing, it's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Pediatric units in hospitals in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Texas have been hit hard. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Fast-Spreading Omicron Variant Drives Up Pediatric Hospitalizations in Parts of U.S. Stay tuned for more. With the fast-spreading Omicron variant now driving new COVID-19 cases up in the United States, public health officials are warning that just as South Africa did in early December, the country is seeing a surge in pediatric hospitalizations related to the disease. The New York Department of Health reported recently that COVID-19 hospitalizations among children under the age of 18 began increasing fourfold the week of December 5th through the current week. No child between the ages of 5 and 11 who was admitted to a hospital with COVID-19 over that period was vaccinated, the department said, and only a third of the children over 11 had received a vaccine. With children under age 5 ineligible for vaccination, officials warned families in New York that the best protection for very young children is to ensure all those around them are fully protected through vaccination, boosters, proper mask wearing, crowd avoidance, and testing. Along with New York, Ohio, Texas, and Pennsylvania have been hit hard by pediatric hospitalizations. Nationwide, about 800 new hospital admissions of children have been reported every day for the past 3 days. Nearly 2,000 pediatric patients with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 cases were hospitalized nationally recently, a 31% increase over 10 days, according to the Washington Post. Data out of the UK also showed that as of December 19th, hospital admissions were at 3.64 per 100,000 for children up to the age of 4, three times the rate of children ages 5 to 14 who are eligible for vaccination. The data follows reports from South Africa earlier this month, which showed that in Gauteng province, as of the first week in December, patients under the age of 5 were the second largest group being admitted to hospitals, after patients over the age of 60. As the Post reported recently, South Africa's wave of infections from the Omicron variant appears to be waning, giving some people hope, to public health experts elsewhere. Among children in the U.S., the vast majority of cases so far have been mild and look a lot like the common cold, reported Washington Post. In the Allentown, Bethlehem area of eastern Pennsylvania, Lehigh Valley Health Network pediatrics chair Dr. Nathan Hagstrom told the Washington Post that hospitalizations of children are double what they were at the previous peak last winter and the highest of the pandemic, but they still represent a small fraction of all those infected. Scientists at the University of Texas released a report recently predicting that Omicron cases in the United States will likely peak In late January through early February, the daily cases slowing down by March.